22 Johnnies. It's Wednesday, the 31st of May, and this is Game On. Coming up today, Nadine Doherty is in studio as we continue our discussion on Gaelic football's possession problem. In Test cricket, we're live to London as Ireland prepare to take on England in Lourdes tomorrow. In tennis, we're going to go live to Roland Garros to check in on week one of the French Open. And in Camogie, we have a championship throw-in to preview with Aoife Murray. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Oh, welcome along. Nadine Doherty is with me in studio. I wasn't supposed to be working today, Nadine, but Shane Dawson asked me to do a swap with him because he has a big cup final. So I just want to wish him luck. It is Shelburne SSE v Arthur Griffith Park, and that is in the Richard Knight Cup final. It's on in Frank Cook Park, Talca Rovers. If anyone is at a loose end and wants to go and check out Shane playing in a cup final, I'm pretty sure he's a goalkeeper.
Yeah, and he's always talking about his football. So, in fairness, fair play to you. You did the right thing there now, Stefan.
I took a hit for the team.
You did. Yeah. You did.
He owes you. I said that to him. If you don't win now, don't come home. Don't come back. We wish him the best of luck, and we'll be keeping an eye on it when I get home this evening to see how it goes. Nadine, I wanted to talk to you about Peter Canavan's comments on the programme last night. So we were talking to him about Gaelic football, particularly the Roscommon-Dublin game. Got about a lot of criticism, wasn't that exciting, difficult to watch. And Canavan believes that it is inevitable the GAA will look to address the growing trend in football that allows possession for possession's sake, something that he feels is spoiling the game. Would you go along with what he's thinking?
Yeah, it's very hard to disagree with Peter the Great now, in fairness.
True, true.
Listen, absolutely, Marie. You know, I was actually at the Mayo Roscommon game in Castlebar a couple of weeks ago, and at times now it was desperate enough stuff to watch. But I think another point to bring up as well, you know, not only has it deteriorated the viewing of the game, it's deteriorated the skill levels of kicking. I mean, if you're a training, you're playing that kind of game, let's say, okay, you're playing possession game, you're probably spending 60 to 70% of your training sessions in condition games, small-sided games. And when we think at the minute, you know, how many intercounty footballers can consistently kick a ball over the bar, not only in a game, but over a season from outside of the 35, like very few.
We don't see too much of it because they're hand passing.
Exactly, but just that skill level, yeah. You know, even when players are in within a scoring range, they're not kicking it. But listen, this isn't, didn't happen overnight. You think back to, I couldn't believe it when I looked it up earlier, 20 years ago in 2003, and we had the famous Pat Spillane puke football. And that
How long
was
ago was that?
2003.
Oh, wow.
Which is incredible. And I mean, that was Peter's own team he was referring to. And at the time, Spillane said, you know, it was so defensive and the last option for that team was to kick the ball. And then, you know, it's evolved. It evolved again since then. We look at Jim McGuinness brought it, I suppose, to a whole new level around 2011 when he took over and from 2012 onwards. And I mean, I remember as a Donegal fan, Marie, being in Croke Park and being in Clonus and Donegal getting booed. But did we care? Mm. We didn't. We were winning Ulsters. We won in All-Ireland. We got to another All-Ireland final in 2012. So, listen, it's evolved, it's growing, and I do agree with Canavan. I think, you know, while it's within the rules, teams aren't going to stop, managers aren't going to stop, but you also have to look at the reasons behind it. You know, I mean, I would find that it's prevalent enough in teams who you could say, I suppose, they're lacking in attack, perhaps. You know, they don't have that trust that if they kick the ball consistently inside that they're going to win possession. It's also a tactic used to deprive the opposition of chances by holding possession, and that's exactly Roscommon's plan against both Mayo and Dublin. And listen, also, if you're up against a team who play, let's say 10, 11, I know teams are playing up to 14 behind the ball, are you going to kick the ball? I mean, the reality is no. So, I mean, it's kind of a myriad of different reasons why this has come about. But I do feel that something is going to have to change, because here we are debating about under 12s, go games, promoting skill levels, and they don't need to kick the ball in certain aspects. And also club football as well, Marie. I mean, Donegal have become the laughing stock of club football in the summer. You'll see Twitter will light up, oh, it's 3-2 at half time in a Donegal club game, and it's happening all over the country. So yeah, I agree with him, something does have to change.
And Peter even made the point as well that, like, what you're seeing then is that you have underage teams doing the same thing, because managers are seeing what's happening in these high profile games and they're taking those tactics, incorporating them into their own teams, which is a natural thing as well.
Yeah, and as you mentioned last week, you know, the Cara Finway. Now, I'm not saying the Cara Finway is like that, but you get clubs who develop a culture on the pitch, a culture off the pitch, and they try and emulate the playing style of the senior team. And absolutely, yeah, it's happening everywhere.
So some of his solutions were that he would make it mandatory to have two or three players in the opposition half. He suggested making the game 13 aside, but then he said even if you had 13 players, they'd end up doing the same thing, so that probably wouldn't work. He said the shot clock, similar to basketball, would be another option to look at. But again, like, there's a big difference between policing five players and 15 players, so it would make it quite difficult. Could you see any way to make it a little bit more entertaining?
I suppose sticking with the basketball team, you know, the backcourt rule in basketball. Do you have a back, halfway line rule in football? I mean, I think a very obvious and simple one is the back pass to the goalkeeper. Cut that out, because that cuts out a huge amount. But then also, I suppose the goalkeeper now is becoming a forward. The goalkeeper is becoming a midfielder. So at what point are you not allowed to pass the ball to the goalkeeper? So listen, it is going to be tricky. I do think what it might bring, if changes do occur, and it could be a good thing, are extra officials. And I don't think there'd be any harm in that, because our officials are under massive pressure at the minute. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a continuous talking point. So if things do change in that aspect, you might get your extra officials. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's we'll see how the season progresses. And look, and when I mentioned the hurling, Peter said, like, obviously you cannot compare hurling and football. And you can't, they're completely different games. But I mean, the reality is, though, they're under the Gaelic Games umbrella. So when you're watching something on television that is taking your breath away, and then you're switching over, and there is no comparison, and they're being played in sometimes in the same county or by the same groups of players, essentially the same kind of the same communities, then there is going to be a comparison. And you know, the hurling fans can get on their high horses for a change.
They can, and deservedly so. But also, I suppose, to bring another code, and you know, our code, it's ladies football as well. Mm. And it has been influenced, and I know we'll talk about it later, and I'm absolutely delighted Donegal Ulster champions, which is fantastic. But I mean, Donegal have focused a huge amount over the last couple of years, especially you could say the last two or three, on that possession based game. Mark McHugh, interestingly, was involved with the Donegal ladies last year. He's now in with Roscommon this year. He obviously was part of Jim McGuinness's team in 2012. Maxi Curran worked with Jim McGuinness in 2012. So you have all these different influences. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you look at Meath as well, two-time All-Ireland champions, massively defensive team. And you would have had teams, we all aspire, I suppose, to move our game plan around beating the All-Ireland champions. So you would have had a lot of teams around the country looking at Meath's defensive system. How are we going to beat it? We're going to keep possession football. We're going to try and draw them out. We're not going to kick the ball unnecessarily. So there is a huge influence in the ladies' game at the minute, and it could continue to grow. So, I mean, if rule changes do come in at the men's level, let's hope we're all integrated at that stage, and it will just filter straight across.
And I guess, Nadine, we're seeing as well figures from maybe that would have traditionally been involved in the men's game now moving to the women's game, because the women's game is becoming more professional. And like, as is Camogie, we're saying the same thing as well, where we have people that might have been members of backroom teams in men's counties now becoming managers and members of backroom teams in Camogie teams. So there is going to be an influence, obviously, too.
Yeah, absolutely. A huge crossover. And I suppose in the past, Marie, what would have happened up to 10 years ago, you would have had a lot of managers using the ladies' codes as a stepping stone, possibly to get into the men's code. But now there's a massive crossover. I mean, McBohan every year he's pipped for different positions. You had David Herity, who was involved with Dublin. He's now at Kildare. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge crossover. Yeah. And as you said, like, with that,
Brian Dowling.
So with that, you are going to get a massive influence. And the ladies' game, it's getting so fast, Marie. You know, it is. And the standards are going up. So it's natural that the influence of the men's game would come into it.
Absolutely. Right, we're going to turn our attention to tennis now. I'm delighted to say that Stephen Higgins of Cross Court View is at the French Open in Roland Garros. How are you, Stephen?
Very good, Mary. How are you?
Living your best life?
Yeah, there was not much Neil Foy's today, but I'll try and make that up for the evening session when I'm back.
So, I haven't been tuned into a huge amount of it yet, because I'm one of these people that just gets on the bandwagon when it starts to get to quarterfinal and semi-final stage. So has there been any shocks? Let's start with the men's side, the women's side of the game.
On the women's side, we haven't seen there were three women coming into the event that were the dominant trio on the tour at the moment. So we have Iga Świątek, obviously the world number one, but her command over the women's game has dropped off a little, because of the rise of Aryna Sabalenka, the Australian Open champion, who's really in superb form at the moment. And then Elena Rybakina, the Wimbledon champion, who of course didn't get any ranking points for Wimbledon last year, but has now kicked on, played extremely well coming into the tournament, won Indian Wells and won Rome on the way in. And she has already beaten Świątek three times this year, including one retirement at Rome. So those two are really snapping at the heels of Świątek. And so there's a lot of pressure on her. She can lose the world number one status after this tournament if she does worse than Sabalenka. But at the moment, there hasn't been massive shots on the women's side.
Okay, what about the men's side?
Well, the men's side is something quite different. So last night, you couldn't really have more of a shock than world number two Daniil Medvedev, who, while never a clay courter naturally, has played very well on the surface this year and actually won Rome, which is usually the domain of Rafael Nadal and Novak Djokovic. Coming into the tournament, he was full of confidence, but unfortunately for him, that didn't count for much against the 172nd ranked Thiago Seebach-Wild, who completely stunned the Russian on Filip Chatrier last night. He won in five sets. He was just firing forehands everywhere. And Medvedev, understandably, like most of the top players, thought he'll never retain this level for five sets. That's why I'm number two and you're 172. But he did. The Brazilian just kept going. The fans were massively in support of him. They loved his real gunslinger style of tennis. And Medvedev actually played okay. Seebach just played the match of his life. So the world number two was gone.
Okay, and what about what's happening with the Ukraine conflict, Stephen?
Yeah, so the Ukraine issue was obviously always bubbling under the surface, particularly because we have so many top-level Ukrainian, Belarusian and Russian players. So from going around to different press conferences and matches, it's always there. So for instance, in Sabalenka's first match, she played Marta Kostyuk, who was a Ukrainian player. It was well in advance known that Marta Kostyuk would not shake hands with her, whatever the result afterwards, because obviously of her stance. But afterwards, it was a bit tense, where I think some of the French fans maybe didn't know that or didn't maybe realise the nationalities of the players. So when Kostyuk just walked to her seat after the match, they booed her. Some booed her quite heavily. Then Sabalenka was going out to try to get her cheer, but kind of stalled because she didn't really know what to do with the situation. But probably with more import afterwards in the press conference, a journalist challenged Sabalenka directly about her stance on the war. And she did, you know, make it fairly certain to make her statement that, you know, if she could do anything to influence the conflict, she would, but they're only tennis players. What do you expect them to do? And then another press conference, Elina Svitolina, who's a very well-known Ukrainian player, was once top five, was kind of talking about, in her quotes, the rubbish that's going around about helping Ukrainians and more needs to be done. So it is always there, bubbling under the surface.
And then just, Stephen, on the Bodyguard app, I've heard a little bit about this, but you might just explain it to any listeners that haven't heard it, what exactly it is and how the players are using it.
Yeah, so as you might expect, like most sports people, tennis players undergo a severe amount of abuse, particularly from people who bet on their matches. I've seen screenshots and players often share, particularly the female players, shocking stuff sent to them because some guy lost 20 euro on their match in, you know, Vladivostok or so, and they like to share that with the player. So before this tournament, the French Tennis Federation have aligned themselves with bodyguard.ai, an automated information software app that basically screens and filters messages before they come into your social media feed. And they've encouraged the players to join up with this to try to reduce the amount of abuse that they see, you know, physically or slash digitally on their phones. Now, from going around with the players in the press conference, it's too early to really tell how effective that is because a number of players have spoken about it, but they haven't downloaded the app or used it themselves. Some players kind of, you know, don't engage with social media at all because of this. Iga Świątek is a proponent and is a fan and is using the app. But I think it's too early to tell statistically, maybe until the end of the tournament when we see proper figures of how effective it's been.
Now, we haven't had a good chat with you in a while, Stephen. Who are you predicting to win the men's and women's French Open?
Well, the men's title, actually both events are really about the top half. And the bottom halves are completely open. So the top half of the men's, you have Carlos Alcaraz, obviously the world number one, one of the most informed player, female informed player at the moment, after having coming back from injury in around February or so, has won a number of tournaments, playing excellently. And he's in the same half as Novak Djokovic, who, of course, has won this before and has won the odd tournament himself in his time. Remember, this is a Rafael Nadal-less Roland Garros, so it is a great opportunity for not only Alcaraz and Djokovic, but now that Medvedev has gone from the bottom half, you might have people like the up-and-coming Holger Rune, Alexander Zverev, if he can find a bit of form, Casper Ruud, last year's finalist. It's very open on the bottom half, particularly for the men. In the top half, you'd be looking at Alcaraz and Djokovic making a semi-final and having a big showdown. And on the women's side, it's really, well, of course there can be shocks. And, you know, I've said this loads of times before, predictions on the women's side, because of best of three, you never really know what's going to happen. But those three women, Świątek, Sabalenka, and Rybakina, have kind of pushed themselves away from the rest of the field. And they really are the three to stop at the moment.
Okay, Stephen Higgins, enjoy the next few days. We'll be checking in with you again very soon. We're going to take a quick break now. Do stay with us, though. We'll be going through all of the ladies' football action when Nadine Doherty will be previewing Ireland's test games at Lords with Nathan Johns. And we'll have Aoife Murray on Camogie.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. So Ireland are going to take on England in Test cricket at Lords starting tomorrow. We're going to preview with Nathan Johns very shortly. But first, John Kenny caught up with Harry Tector, who recently entered the top 10 in men's ODI batting rankings.
Game on.
Cricket.
Congratulations, Harry. Elevation to number 7 in the world, and some illustrious names on that list as well. What does that mean to you, or does it mean anything to you at all?
Doesn't mean all that much, to be honest. It's obviously a nice accolade and stuff, and probably a reflection of my form over the last sort of 2 years, and that's nice, but it doesn't really do much for me. And I think a good test will be if I can stay, you know, in that top 10 for a long period of time, and that's the plan.
The only problem, I suppose, at the moment from Ireland's point of view is you're just not getting over the line. You're getting close to the top teams as well, and it's just to fall over that line to get victories. That needs to follow, doesn't it? You've got to get yourself into a winning mentality, and I presume that's permeating throughout the squad. That's what you need.
Yeah, I mean, it's something we've spoken about, I think, with the Super League. You could count on your hand the amount of times, you know, games went down to the last ball or the last over, and that's really disappointing, because fall of a ball here or there, we're probably qualified for a World Cup already. So that's hard to take, and it's something that we've spoken about, and we're going to have to get right at the qualifiers.
The Lord's Test is looming, and obviously it's something you're very much looking forward to, I'd say. You'd watched the last test, from the first test for Ireland in at Lords. What did you make of it? It's just watching on before and realising a dream of playing in it.
Yeah, well, it was amazing, wasn't it, watching Mertz do what he did that first morning. I mean, you talk to all the lads who played it, they say it's one of their favourite moments in an Irish shirt. So to be involved this time is going to be something really special. I know we've all got a lot of family and friends going over, which will be really special. Hopefully Lords will turn green for a few days, and yeah, really, really looking forward to it.
And you've seen shots of the long room and the walking through and the members there as well. It's not just a game of cricket, is it? This is all about a lot about history, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's the home of cricket, really, isn't it? It's one of the world's most historic grounds, and for us to be playing a test match there, the significance can't be understated. It's a huge event against England, the start of their test summer and Ashes summer, so it's not only a massive game for us, it's a big game for them as well.
But you don't want to just turn up and make the numbers, do you?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I think if we play our best, we're more than capable of competing with all the big boys, and we've shown that over a period of time now. I think our challenge is, can we extend good sessions to good days and add good days up? And that's going to be our challenge when we don't play domestic Red Bull cricket. We're going to have to learn on the job and at the highest standard of the game, and that's not an easy thing to do. But, you know, we're all trying really hard, practicing really hard, and hopefully come the first day we can get it right.
In terms of test matches as well, there's some coming thinking fast now, which is great to see after a long wait to get onto the test scene. But there's also the T20, the 50 over qualifiers as well, so it's a very busy summer for you, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really busy. I think it's something like 170 odd out of the first 190 days we're away from home or we're in camp, so it's a busy year, playing a lot of pressure cricket. The Lord's Test will be great, but really for me, my focus is on the 50 over World Cup qualifiers first and foremost, and then we are home for 5 days, and then we go to the T20 World Cup qualifiers. So hopefully come the end of those, we'll have qualified for both, and everyone will get a well-earned rest for a little few days.
Ireland cricketer Harry Tector speaking to John Kenny. I'm delighted to say now that Nathan Jones of the Irish Times joins us now. How are you, Nathan?
Hi, Murray, how are you?
So are you over there, ready to go?
Yeah, over in London, can't wait. Yeah, it's been a brilliant week. The best part about Lord's Week is the build-up almost. Just going into that ground almost every day to chat to the lads before in the build-up or what have you. It's really special.
So will it be sold out tomorrow?
As far as I'm aware, like, it's the first, like Harry touched on it there, it's the first game of their summer. So there's a lot of prestige attached to that, and it's probably easier to get a ticket as an England fan for the Ireland games than it is for the Aussie games coming up that they've got later on this summer. So I'm expecting it to be sold out, especially because, you know, there'll be hordes of Irish coming over.
Yeah, and the weather's so nice as well. I'd be jealous. I'd actually like to go to Lourdes sometime when the weather is nice. Just let's touch on Harry there for a second, and just his good form and the consistency of play from him as well. Where is it come from, and how much more can he improve?
Yeah, that's the question, isn't it? Because one of the main talking points over here amongst a lot of the English media as well is, look at like someone like Harry and how little high quality domestic cricket he's played, because obviously the English domestic structure is so much better than the Irish domestic structure, and he's had to learn his game on the go in international cricket. And it's kind of like, well, if he's learning his game and he's gotten this good 2 or 3 years in without the week in week out of good domestic stuff, you know, where can he go? The ceiling is presumably quite high, and you know, I would agree with that. I think he has got quite a lot to go, even though he's obviously, you know, seventh in the world or whatever it is. So he's got a hell of a long way to go. And I think his mentality is there as well. I mean, you speak to him, he's for a 23-year-old chap, he thinks about the game very deeply. He knows his own game and he understands it very well. And he's got this doggedness that separates great athletes from the best ones, I think, personally. He has this attitude of, he refuses to be beaten, and you know, a lot of sports people have that, but not a lot of people have it to that extent, I think.
The qualifying for the World Cups is obviously on the horizon, and you know, even heard Harry there speaking about it, Andy Balbirnie has been speaking about it as well. But just for this test cricket at Lourdes, what do they want to get out of it, and what would success be for an Ireland team now playing for the next few days?
Yeah, I mean, well, that's also something that's dominated. There's a lot of negative reaction amongst punters who have flown over, saying we're not too happy with them talking down this occasion. Mm. Like, everyone understands that the what's to come is also important. You know, financially, it's more important than this. But, you know, the prestige that's attached to this is also very important. And I think that needs to be respected. And the players certainly do respect that. I wouldn't question their desire. In terms of what represents success, if they can get a couple of sessions where they're, you know, on top and competitive, and you know, if they turn it into a 4-day game, if it doesn't finish too early, and like I said, they get a couple of individuals like Harry or whoever it is does well with the bat, and you know, they take it 4 days, and the last couple of tests they've lost by considerable margins, if they can improve on those margins, I think they'll be absolutely delighted, because this is, England are probably the best test side in the world at the minute.
So Harry mentioned the pressure that England are under, or just because of where it is and the start of their season. Just give us a little bit of context on why this is important for England as well.
Yeah, well, it's massive for England, because obviously they've got the Ashes coming up, which is their biennial series against Australia. That's obviously their be-all and end-all. And this is their only real proper warm-up for that. It's interesting, because they probably, the English side, the best English side is probably already decided. It's not the side that's playing this week, but you know, there probably is scope for one or two guys maybe to force their way in and kind of move up the pecking order if injuries happen, etc. You know, it's the pressure that they have for what is their be all and end all of their summer. So there's a decent amount of pressure on them.
And for Ireland, after they get over this, tell us about the World Cups and how important it is for them to qualify for them, Nathan.
Well, that's where the money is in cricket these days. You don't make any money playing test cricket, just because it costs so much to play 4 or 5 consecutive days. So, and all the TV broadcasting money is all about the global events. They missed out on the 2019 World Cup in England, which England won, which Owen Morgan captained them to. So that was devastating. So financially, it's huge. They've got two tournaments, one in India the end of this year, and then there's another one over in the Caribbean and the States in 2024, and both qualifying events for those are in this summer, so back-to-back June and July. So, you know, financially, they need to get back into that. And equally, you know, globally at the minute, more people, as much as this test match as Lourdes is a huge opportunity, globally, more people are watching the shorter format games. So it's massive for Ireland from a global perspective that they do qualify.
Can they get consistency? Because that's something that always comes into the conversation with this Ireland team.
Well, they need to. I mean, John touched on it with Harry there. They've lost an incredible amount of really tight games. And so they played well, but not well enough to win enough matches. I would say that they're only just about now, in the last 2 years, getting the volume of fixtures and high quality fixtures that they need to develop this sort of consistency. So you would only hope that, you know, with another year, another 2 years of playing the amount that they are playing, which is fantastic for everyone involved, they've shown skills, and you would hope that they develop that consistency, because they absolutely need to. But like I said, you can understand a little bit why it's not there, because it's only the last year or two since COVID that they're finally getting that many matches, which is what they need.
Okay, Nathan Johns, not Nathan Jones, as I called you earlier, the former Southampton manager. I don't know why, every time I was watching Nathan Jones, I always thought of you. So this was inevitable, it was going to happen anyway, Nathan. So thank you so much.
I'll take it as a compliment.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Nathan. And sure, we'll check in with you over the next few days. Enjoy the sunshine, enjoy the work. And as you said, actually, just before we go, because I did want to ask you about Josh Little and him not being involved. Is this significant? I know there's been a lot of conversation about Josh and what his role in the future of Ireland cricket is going to be. Could you maybe just explain the situation with Josh Little for our listeners, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So Josh has become the first Irish player, or current Irish international, so excluding Owen Morgan, to play in the Indian Premier League, which is the biggest domestic competition in the world. You know, we talked about TV money earlier with an audience size of India. The money that gets pumped into that competition is astronomical. He's earning close to $500,000. Just for 2 months' work, roughly, playing over there. The problem is it clashes with a hell of a lot of Ireland games. Ireland said to him, you can go off and play in this and miss some games, but come back for others. One of the games that they said he could miss was this test match at Lord's. And the IPL only finished May 29th, which is, what, 2 days ago now, I think. So logistically, it would have been almost impossible for him to get on a plane and then play a red ball match, having just played short form T20 cricket. So the player asked for a rest, so he's good to go and fit and healthy for the qualifying events that are the so-called pinnacle events coming up. The players in the squad have absolutely no issues with this. There's no rift in the squad, so to speak, which is what some people are worried about. And they appreciate that he's got an opportunity that hasn't come up for Irish players before, and it's a life-changing opportunity, both in terms of his game and financially. But the issue is, this will happen more and more as time goes on. So there's going to come a point where it's like, yes, you can play some games and not play other games, but there's going to become a point where how much is too much in terms of what you miss. And people are starting to have these conversations, and people are worried that this may lead to a rift between not so much the team and Josh, but the powers that be behind the team and what they say he can and cannot do. And the worry is that he ends up signing a contract with a domestic franchise and gives up his Ireland contract, which means he doesn't play for Ireland that much. And that is a bit of a concern right now. But it's a hypothetical as things stand.
In terms of those figures, Nathan, like, that's absolutely huge money, and obviously completely unheard of in Irish cricket, in a sense. Like, are there any other players up and coming who could in the future perhaps take up an opportunity like that? Like, is there anybody who we should be listening for?
Yeah, well, you just heard from one of them, Harry Tector. If he can get his, you know, we've mentioned that he's gotten that ranking in 50 over cricket. If he can get that into shorter format T20, he'll be one of the hottest properties out there as well. He has a little bit, but if he can do so even more, he'll be out there. The only issue with him is he's been touted as a future Ireland captain from the age of about 11. Obviously, if he wants to captain Ireland, then there are sacrifices he'd have to make, and he can't be missing the amount of game time that other players could miss if you're in charge. So that's another layer to it as well. But him, Lorcan Tucker, is another one as well. Yeah, he's a little bit older than Josh and Harry. He's 26. The other guys are 23, 24. But he's another one who potentially could start going down that route as well. But for now, it's probably three or four players. They need to get their policy and how they deal with it right now. So if in 5 years' time it's more than that and it starts becoming 7, 8, 9 players, that they need to get the policy right so it doesn't cripple the whole squad.
And just as well on Josh, like, can you give us maybe just some comparisons to how big a star he is now in international cricket?
Yeah, like I said, he played in the final of the IPL with guys like, you know, Mahendra Singh Dhoni, who's the legendary India captain, like, won that game. Josh's side lost, and you know, he's top 20 richest athletes in the world, and he doesn't even play international cricket anymore. You know, so we're talking. He's rubbing shoulders with these guys day in, day out for a really intense 8-week period. That's how long the competition is. So it's unheard of. Like I said, he seems to be taking it in a stride. To be fair to him, I spoke to somebody who used to coach him because there was a debate about, well, he hasn't lit the world alight. Is it disappointing considering he has that price tag? But someone who used to coach him said to me, he just said, look, the fact that he's gone out there and is not completely embarrassed himself is a massive win, because that level is just, it is next level. Like, you know, when you're rubbing shoulders with guys who are on the rich list like that, you know, those guys are good. There's a reason why they're that rich, you know? So he's acquitted himself well, and he's like I said, he's catapulted himself beyond the level of any other Irish player in the past.
And Nathan, I suppose just to clarify for listeners, because I suppose we wouldn't really know the process, like, how did that move come about for him? How was he spotted? You know, how did it come about?
Yes, so it's quite arbitrary in that it's completely up to the individual teams who they want to sign. There's an auction process that happens, and that's a whole event with razzmatazz. It's kind of like the NFL draft or NBA draft, which might be more recognisable to people. But there's an auction, you put your name forward for the auction. If teams might be interested in you, your name gets called, and there's a bidding process. And that's what happened with Josh. There was two or three teams, I think, who were constantly bidding for him. And obviously, the more people that bid for you, the higher the price, the more value that you get as a player. So the player sees the money that is paid at the auction. And so he would have performed well for Ireland. He performed really well at the World Cup last October, November. You know, was instrumental when Ireland beat England, took a hat-trick against New Zealand, and performances like that, plus with what he was doing at a few other smaller leagues around the world, got people noticed, and coaches and analysts sit down and go, right, we want this guy, we want that guy. And Josh's one that was up, name was on their list. And like I said, two or three teams bid for him. So he would have had a starting price, and that starting price skyrocketed pretty quickly the longer the bids came in.
And in terms of fame, so like, if he was walking down the street here, he probably wouldn't get recognised. But if he was walking down the street in India, would everybody know who he is?
He's getting to that stage, yeah. He actually put up a really funny Instagram story today because he was flying back. He's on his way back from, or over the last 24 hours at some point. I saw the story at some point today. And it was a message from somebody who had sat next to him on his flight home saying, I thought that was you. I'm really gutted I didn't take a selfie with you. I couldn't believe that was you or not.
We've lost Nathan. That was Nathan Johns of the Irish Times. We'll be keeping a check-in with him over the next few days while Ireland take on England in Test cricket. At Lords, we're going to take a very quick break now, though, and we will be heading to talk Camogie with Aoife Murray very shortly.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. I'm delighted to say that Aoife Murray joins me now on the line. Aoife, how are you?
Really good, thank you.
Championship time.
I know. I know it comes around quick in the end, doesn't it?
It comes around quick, and it comes around every year.
Yeah. Nearly as exciting as Christmas.
Almost, right. Almost. Well, it always is when it starts, because, you know, you're just trying to figure things out. But it's kind of, it's starting off with a bang, really, isn't it? With Cork and Galway on Saturday.
Yeah.
Which is a big one to get going.
It is, and you know, if you're the other three teams going out, they're almost going under the radar in many ways, aren't they? Because the main talk will be about Galway and Cork, and it's probably a great way to start off a championship, I suppose, for Camogie, really, because it is starting with a bang, the two league finalists, so many different stories. Cork, could this be their third defeat in a row? And I think we've said this a number of times, that winning is a habit, but, you know, not winning can be a habit as well. And so there's going to be a huge pressure, I think, on Cork this weekend. Huge pressure, really, to start with. And, you know, there is the kind of look of a draw of a semi-final at place for possibly one of those teams out of their first round of the championship.
I know Cork people wouldn't pay too much attention to records unless they're the ones holding all the aces, but Galway and Cork have met four times in the championship since 2019, and Galway have come out on top on all four occasions.
Yeah, we only like to talk about records in Cork when they're in our favour. That's all we cared about. But it is true, and you know, it's, I suppose in many ways it's nearly a testament to how Cathal Murray really has brought, I suppose, that talented underage up into a, you know, a pretty defiant team with a huge amount of self-belief. And I know from, I suppose, the early noughties and into the teens there, we always thought mentally we could break them in that last 10-15 minutes, whereas it's nearly flipped. It's nearly flipped in many ways. And I think certainly in the last few games, those last 10 minutes, they've really come to the fore. So I think a huge credit has to go down to, I suppose, how he has managed. He's probably person managed those people, those players. I think over the last number of years, I think a huge credit has to go to him.
So let's have a look at the teams, both missing quite a lot of senior players. And I guess we'll start with Cork IFA. We were talking about Donegal football earlier, and there was a few players were sprung back in to action. Do you see anyone returning, or are we still looking at a case where Hannah Looney, Aisling Thompson, Katrina Mackey, Orla Cronin are not around?
I think you could see the likes of Orla Cronin definitely involved. I hope so anyway. It'll be interesting to see how they line out, but at the same time, you always just have to play the team that you have. And I think, in fairness, that centre field hasn't been their downfall without the likes of Aisling Thompson. I think the likes of Saoirse, how well she settled in there, and when she actually gets into the game and how she drives forward and is able to score from the 55 out is a huge option for Cork. I think the big one for me this weekend really is that battle between Amy O'Connor and Shauna Healy, assuming Shauna goes back on Amy, because it really has been kind of 2-0 in many ways from the the last round of the league to the final. I think how she's managed to kind of restrain Amy, I think that's been a fascinating battle. That's probably the one big shout that I would have. If Cork can get to grips around the centre and that half back area, or the half forward area, I think they could be there with a shout. And then even looking at the likes of O'Reilly in the forwards, who played a little bit of a different role in that league final. She almost became more of a playmaker than a finisher. I would have always seen her as a finisher, but I think she set up a huge amount and really kept Cork backs occupied to allow the others, like the Rabbits, Blacks, McPeaks, etc., really into the game. So there's a huge amount of talk around the players that are playing, never mind the ones that may not be there this weekend.
Or the ones that may come back. Galway should have a few players coming back as well. McGrath, Sarah Dervin has to reinstate herself at some stage, I'd imagine, back in that team as well. But Galway never seem to be short players when they seem to find them everywhere, or the players that have been on the bench are well able to step up when the time comes as well, it seems, Aoife.
Yeah, I think we've chatted a good few times about their bench, haven't we, with regard to, you know, the majority of those would be guaranteed starters in nearly all of the other senior teams, and they've been blessed with that. And it must be a hard situation to manage when you have such a strong bench. And sometimes I actually nearly felt it nearly went against them, because it was, who do you start and who do you finish with, you know? But I think Cottle has managed that really well, and as probably testament to winning this league with just how strong that bench was, because when those players did step away, he had, I suppose, the firepower to bring on who were very comfortable at that level. So certainly he's been able to manage that blend. If those players do come back, like, they're going to be a force, really, aren't they, to be reckoned with, whereas Cork are kind of still in that transition period, aren't they? And bringing up a few of those minor players.
Like, I think, Aoife, we've been in that transition for a while. Nadine is here across me now, and she's nodding away to the word transition.
Yeah, Aoife, be careful, because
I love it.
I was going transition for Donegal for the last 2 months, and they won that Ulster Championship. So just go easy with it. Just protect yourself there.
We love it. It's a catch-all, isn't it?
It
saves us on so many occasions. But I think. Look, in all fairness, I think you are right, though, in the sense of using that term, because we haven't been successful, I suppose, in Cork Camogie for so long. And it is that. When do you put your hand up to say we've gone past the point of transition? I think for Cork, bringing on some of those minor players through, the likes of the Orla Callan, seeing how well she's beginning to settle into that team. But that's really only one player of them. So it'll be interesting to see, can she do that over the 60 plus minutes? I totally take your point on transition. I think it is a time where maybe we have to hold our hands up in Cork with regard to where we are actually at in the process.
Yeah, just get on with winning again. Maybe that.
That's it. So simple.
Yeah. So close. on so many, well, in recent times particularly. Let's look at the broader picture, though. So we've touched on Cork and Galway there, and as always, Kilkenny are knocking around, waiting for their chance to kind of hit full tilt, which usually doesn't happen till later in the season. They like to win things the hard way or grind out the victories, which is a bit of a trademark of this team. But from their point of view, it feels like they're kind of getting the players that were out injured last year kind of back fit again. And of course, they did come up with some players last year and some new positioning and all the rest. Mm-hmm. Do you think we're going to see them getting going earlier this season?
I suppose, look, it's hard to say because I think they did finish the league better. Mm. I think they had a good Leinster Championship. For me, I suppose what we were beginning to see was this kind of battle-hardened team, and a bit of grit that was beginning to come out, because in fairness, I suppose they didn't have the luxury of a huge panel due to a lot of injuries, some serious unlucky incidents there for them. And I think what you might see with them is becoming this real hard team to beat. They'll bring it into an arm wrestle, they'll get you into an arm wrestle, and then all of a sudden they'll have 10 points on you. And I think it might take them a while to get going, but listen, I most certainly would not write them off, even when they had a strong panel. Never mind if they bring in that grit and determination and fight, I think they'll absolutely be there towards the end of the championship.
Tipperary should be interesting this year, given that they'd won that first Munster title in 13 years. New manager there in Dennis Kelly, Cote d'Avan, doing what she always does. Mm. But starting to find that way to win, and possibly, do you think, maybe getting a little bit closer to the top table this year?
I do, and I think looking at all of those teams, we always talk about Cork, Galway, and Tipperary, Cork, Galway, and Kilkenny, apologies. Yeah. And then we kind of have a hope value for a fourth or a third or a fifth four team coming into it. I think it's going to be really interesting to see the likes of Tipperary and Waterford. Mm-hmm. What do they actually do in this year's championship? Because in fairness to both teams, they've began to develop this way of playing, their own style. They're not trying to stop other teams from playing and then hoping that they do something towards the end of the game. So I think it'd be really interesting to see the likes of Tipperary and Waterford. Tipperary, especially after getting a huge boost of confidence from winning that Munster title, I think was the first time since 2010. 13
years.
So getting, I suppose, the taste of having a cup, getting the cup back into the dressing room, getting it on a bus, like all those little kind of things that you might get 5% extra energy from. They come to training more positive. They'll believe in the coaches. They believe in the managers, etc. The same with Waterford winning that division 1B, I think it is. Them, and actually with Waterford, the likes of Flynn, Fitzgerald, Kermit, all these people beginning to step up, that you're not just looking at the Rockets, etc., Cartons and so on for Waterford. I am really hopeful that, you know, the likes of Waterford and Tip will really, really push those top three teams. And I do think you could see a little bit of a shock, especially semi-final, final stage this year.
And would you put like the likes of Clare and Dublin then in the next tier down, pushing the chasing pack?
Yeah, it's a hard one, I suppose. Looking at Down, Clare, Antrim, Offaly, all those teams, Limerick that are out at this weekend, they've had up and down years so far. You know, Down winning the Munster, I think, or the Ulster being a big positive for them. But again, I think they rely so much on Mullen. It's very hard to see where they're going to get those extra players to have a surprise. Limerick having a real poor Munster, even hearing Lillis, their manager, speak very honestly after that game, and he didn't hold back how they went off script, and you know they've lost four of the five league games. Antrim, I thought Antrim were very much on an upward curve. They've got a really strong second team, but they haven't seemed to push on in the last few games, getting beaten by Down and the Ulster. I think you might be looking at the likes of Offaly and Limerick and seeing how they actually get on. But it Group 3 is going to be interesting because you've got those four teams, Antrim, Limerick, Offaly and Waterford, in it. But I do worry about the likes of Offaly and Limerick in the championship this year.
Okay, so in a word, Aoife, who is going to be walking the steps of the Hogan on All-Ireland final day?
I don't know.
In a word,
hope value obviously is for Cork, but I think it's Galway's really at the moment, as I sit here right now, Marie. I think it's a hard one to see past Galway.
Okay, Aoife Murray, thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk to you next week. Nadine, we're going to look back at a very interesting weekend of ladies football action. I want to start with Armagh and Donegal. Donegal pulling that Ulster Championship win out of the fire, fully deserving of the win. And I have to say, I don't think anyone thought they were going to get it.
Oh, no, what's the saying? If we knew then what we know now, as in Niamh Hegarty and Tanya Kennedy. But just to put it into context, Marie, what an incredible achievement it was. I just have stats here. Like, so they won one game out of nine so far this year. They conceded 1889 and had a scoring average of 1.5. So anybody who remotely thought it was a possibility, fair play to them. Also add to that, names from last year gone. Evelyn McGinley, full-back. Shelley Tuig didn't feature, midfielder. Jolie McLaughlin, Yvonne Bonner, Blana McLaughlin injured, Rashi McCafferty, their goalkeeper, all gone from last year. So, I mean, absolutely incredible. And just to bring in the provincials, you know, a lot of people are saying that the provincials aren't important. If you saw the celebrations of those Donegal girls at the weekend, it would completely change your mind. And if anybody can catch an interview with Karen Guthrie, it's with the Donegal Daily. I think it's online on YouTube. Raw, emotive, unbelievable. But yeah, Marie, listen, fully deserving. Credit to the management. Maxie pulled it out of the bag again. And listen, it's common knowledge, and I mean, Niamh Hegarty just added so much up front. I mean, I remember Niamh coming through as an underage player. She came in at centre forward. I literally was happy enough to just hand her that number 11 jersey and happily retire. She reeled in the ears at the weekend. She was unbelievable. And Tanya Kennedy, again, putting it into context, Amy Mackin scored 9 points against Donegal 2 weeks ago, 6 from play. She scored 1 point from play.
She did her job.
Yeah. Tanya's amazing. And I mean, to come in back from Australia, to come in on, you know, I don't know how long Maxie's been in touch with her. Obviously, she's been training, but I mean, what a player. And massive credit, Marie, to those girls who have been there from day one of the league through very, very bleak times when I sat here, doubted them. Everybody sat doubting them. So massive fair play to them. And listen, last year's player of the year, you have to give her a mention as well. Niamh McLaughlin, unbelievable. And I suppose very quickly, just to touch on Armagh, you know, they didn't come up. We spoke about it last week. I said that Donegal would play massive numbers behind the ball. They didn't come up with any strategies. They knew that Amy Mackin would be double marked. Now, they probably didn't know Tanya Kennedy would be there, but they just continued to do the same things that weren't working. And we've talked all year about that defence that, you know, can be exposed. And like Donegal for the last 3 years, they didn't carry the favourites tag well, and Donegal were fully, fully deserving of their win. And I'm absolutely delighted for them, obviously.
So Cork got one over on Kerry as well, beating them 5-14 to 2-17. How much of a setback is this for Kerry, just given their plans for the season, or the fact they've been touted as being All-Ireland contenders?
Yeah, Marie, it's kind of just gone backwards for Kerry. Mm. And I spoke last week about it being a big psychological test because they haven't won Munster in a couple of years. They look very sluggish. I think they'd be more concerned about their performance. Really sluggish. I mean, Cork absolutely blew them out of the water in that first half, especially in those first 10 minutes. First 15 minutes, sorry, Cork were 10 points up. Kerry just could not keep with them. They really missed Shifra O'Shea up front, Marie, but huge credit to Cork. Massive things for them. The confidence, obviously, that intensity. They played two-touch football, Marie, for a good chunk of that game, and it worked to perfection. They went one-on-one in the Kerry kick-out, absolutely destroyed that kick-out, gave them a great platform, and they got their matchups right. And the matchups worked really, really well in that first half that gave them the platform. I think particularly Melissa Duggan had a super game on Hannah O'Donoghue. Anna Ryan nullified Niamh Carmody. Roisin Phelan took out Danielle O'Leary. And Louise Murhurtig came in and patches, and Emer Meany did quite well in her, but the confidence was low. And I think a massive shout out in terms of Cork, Katie Quirk in midfield. I haven't seen Koch Lynch chase shadows like that around the middle in a long time. And Kira Sullivan was fantastic in the middle, and obviously inside, Dern O'Sullivan got her 10 or 11 points. But crucial to it as well, Marie, Cork's fifth goal, it was midway through the half. Kerry had missed the penalty. They were kind of pushing, and it was just poor goalkeeping by Kira Butler. She was very unlucky, let that ball go underneath her, and that just gave Cork the platform to hold on.
And very briefly, Nadine, were Dublin impressive or were Meath unimpressive?
combination of both, really, Marie Meath. Just look, pure intensity again, and when you play that smash and grab game without intensity, it just doesn't work. I think Dublin will be, they'll be delighted. Listen, 10th Leinster in a row, they used the width that we spoke about, they got their two goals that were crucial, they played the direct running game. And what I could say about Dublin at the minute, while they haven't lit up anything, Marie, they're really well placed for what is now a really, really open championship. Massively open.
Okay, Nadine, thank you so much for coming in. That is all we have time for. Do tune in tomorrow to find out if Shane won his cup final. He'll be in looking ahead to all of the weekend sport. RTE 2FM.